Hey guys, welcome to episode 17 of the Aspiring Polymath. I'm here with a true polymath that I recently just discovered. Well, I didn't just discover him, but I discovered his different interests lately. Prince Uzo Chijoke. Prince, you want to introduce yourself?
Hey everyone, my name is Prince Uzo Chijoke. Some people call me Prince. I go by Uzo in the creative realm. But yes, I'm a writer, I'm a game creator, and far as education, pharmacy. So I've done a lot of different things, spanning from the traditional STEM route to engaging in a lot of different creative adventures. So thank you for having me.
No worries. Thanks for coming on. So let's, I guess, start at the beginning. So which one of those came first?
It was the card game, actually. So in 2020, after a fun trip with friends in Vegas, I thought to create a card game that discussed crazy hypothetical situations. So that summer I designed it. And then in the fall of 2020, I launched Never Say Never, the hilarious game of horrible hypotheticals on Kickstarter. I crowdfunded it, reached the goal, and then now it's for sale on Amazon, and I have other games in development, but in the meantime, the focus game-wise is on Never Say Never.
Okay, that's cool. I think I actually played that game before. I don't know if I played it with the card version or if it's, maybe I'm thinking of another game, I don't know, but I could have sworn I've played Never Say Never before.
Oh, you might be thinking of Never Have I Ever.
Unless I've played with the card game, maybe it's Never Have I Ever. I'm thinking.
Unless you were at one of the Dallas game nights where I had the game with me. Yeah.
It might have been one of those Real Faces events where I saw the game. I don't know, but I feel like I played it before. But yeah. So what got you into that? Because I've always had this. When we discussed, I don't know if it was 2 weeks ago, I've always had this idea about creating a game, but my thing is board games. I'm not really, apart from poker, I'm not really a card game person. So my thing is board games, but they seem to be a bit more, it seems to be a lot more moving pieces to actually get them out. How did you put the pieces together when you decided that you wanted to do that? Where did you start from? Because I know people only see the finished product, like, oh, you made a card game, but they don't know what all led to that point.
Yeah. So, of course it all starts with an idea. And then, you start thinking through the content, but the biggest piece is the rules, because if you don't have the rules correct, then it's not fun for people. So, after I had an initial rule set designed, I asked some friends or trusted people, like, who would be interested in playtesting for me. So for all of them, I actually mailed them out like a printable version of the game, very rudimentary, and had them cut things out and then play with their friends and give me feedback. So the original version of the game is actually a lot different than the version that I actually ended up selling in the end, because the feedback I got gave me a whole different angle to take the gameplay rules.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be very important. So for example, the game I was talking to you about, I don't think I ever told you the name. We had a couple working names to go with. But the first name I came up with was Jacoban. That was the first name. So where I got that idea from was one of my favorite games. I'd say probably my second favorite game is Monopoly. And every time you want to play Monopoly, there's one thing people always say. People always say it takes too long. It takes too long. Monopoly takes too long. I don't play. So my initial idea was, okay, let me create a version of Monopoly that doesn't take as long. It's like, basically like Monopoly Lite or Speed or something. I know they have the Speed Die Monopoly, but nobody ever uses it. I don't even know how it works. So my idea was create a version of Monopoly that's quicker and then put like a Nigerian spin on it. So instead of like regular Monopoly, it's set in Nigeria with Nigerian cities and the characters are Nigerian and all that. And but then coming up with the rule set was the most complicated part. I could not imagine how complicated it could be, but I came up with this complex system, you know, like everything thought out, like this character has this advantage and that disadvantage, and I thought, great, this is perfect. And then I showed it to some of my friends and they were like, nah, that's too complicated.
Yeah.
So it's, I guess that's another part that you have to consider when you're putting those together. And I'm still in the process of bringing that to life. But I just saying all that to say, I really have appreciation for people that put games together, because when you see the finished product, you don't really know what all went into it. It's just, you know, nice to play and all that. And people can be critical of stuff like that without really realizing how difficult it is. But I guess at the end of the day, you want to make something that people like. Otherwise, you know, what's the point, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, and there's different types of, you know, audiences for the games. Because the same people that would play Uno would play Cards Against Humanity too, you know? But that's two different styles of play. One is everyone is sitting around listening to people talk and laughing. And the other is competitive, where... or more competitive, where one person is the winner and, you know, they talk their trash after they win, you know, and you play again.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point that you made. I don't know, maybe somebody has some game theory out there about that, because I am not a huge fan of both Uno and Cards Against Humanity. So it's interesting that you group them together. but anyways, so before the card game, though, you were... if I'm not mistaken, you're a pharmacist, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you're a pharmacist, and I think you're a veteran as well.
Yes, yeah, Army veteran.
So what's the story behind that? Like, which one of these interests came first? Like writing or becoming a pharmacist, or was it like the African parent, you know, become a pharmacist thing? Is that kind of how you went that route?
Yeah, definitely the, you know, doctor, lawyer, engineer. conditioning. So yeah, I went to undergrad, and it's funny because actually when I was leaving to go to basic training for the Army, and I had already taken my PCAT exam, which is the pharmacy school entrance exam, and I was like, you know what, let me apply and see what happens. I had actually like not thought about pharmacy for a couple of years, and I submitted the application and then I left for basic training. And then when I was able to check my email again, I had an interview at Howard. So yeah. So then, like, as soon as I got back from Army training, I interviewed for pharmacy school, and then I got in, and then I was juggling both because I was doing the Army reserves.
Oh, wow. That's nice. That's okay. That's a lot to do at the same time. The Army Reserve, is it like 1 weekend a month, or what is it?
Yeah, 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks in the summer is kind of how they push it.
Okay. So you finish pharmacy school, and then at that point you decide you want to follow some of these other passions, or where does the story go from there?
Yeah. I think, you know, in finishing pharmacy school and kind of establishing, you know, that baseline to be able to take care of myself, that's what led me explore some of these other interests. I think like a lot of people, I went down the real estate route of, you know, trying to flip houses and all that, which, you know, is good, but I don't think that's really like my passion. You know, I see, you know, the income potential from it, but yeah, like flipping houses and dealing with contractors wasn't really something that I enjoyed too much. But I've always had ideas for stories that I would like to see on television or something. I just didn't know how accessible it was to be able to try and write these stories. So it was actually 2017 where I first tried my hand at writing a book. And, you know, went through that process, and, you know, without giving too much, I'll fast forward to the last year where, someone that I was talking to who also, was a writer, but on the screenplay side, so that's television and movies. He was like, hey, you know, you've been writing these books, you should consider writing a screenplay. And once I started seeing scripts, that's what kind of convinced me that was a bit of a more accessible route for me as far as leveraging, you know, my creative talent into writing.
Okay. We'll get to the writing part a bit more later on. I want to talk about this project that you have coming out, without giving away too much detail, of course. But before that, the Instagram videos. I think that was the first thing I knew you for, really. The Instagram videos, the African Dad Instagram videos. How did you get into that? What was the motivation for you? Is there a real person behind that motivation, or is it kind of like an amalgamation of a bunch of different people?
So it's funny because I actually tried that before, before Instagram. I tried it on, like, when Twitter had Vine. So I had an account on Twitter that was pretty popular called African Dad. Not a lot of people. I mean, it was, you know, years ago, but yeah, I had a pretty popular Twitter account where I was doing comedy kind of things as an African dad talking on Twitter. And, you know, I tried to do videos then, didn't really know how to navigate that stuff. You didn't have all the technology like TikTok or IG has with editing. So I left it alone. And then I think again, during the pandemic, that was like the rise of TikTok. And I had ideas for videos. I didn't want to do them though. I wanted to just write ideas for other people, but I couldn't find anyone that wanted to just take the random skits and sketches ideas I had and do them. So I was like, well, let me just do some myself and see how they go. So really it was because, you know, I couldn't find anyone else to do them, and I had ideas that I wanted to see materialized. And then some of it was, I just wanted to test out like comedic timing and see what people reacted to, and what, like, what kind of formula could I create that would make people laugh more than others. And so I noticed in some videos that they'll get more attention than others, and I'm okay, so this works here and this doesn't, and that kind of gives me some insight if I'm writing comedy, you know, on a script.
That's pretty interesting. I never really thought of it that way. So it's kind of like, in a way, you're kind of gaming it a little bit. So when you just put out content in numbers, you can get data to reinforce what you put out next.
Yeah. So I would play around with, you know, do I do hashtags on this video or do I not? If I do hashtags, does that actually get me more views? You know, or do I just let it like do for itself? And so I've just been doing a lot of different experiments to see what resonates with people. And what makes people laugh harder than others.
So how much of that did you figure out yourself, and how much did you maybe get from another source? Because what you're saying reminds me a lot of, have you heard of Gary Vee? Gary Vaynerchuk?
Yeah. I mean, maybe that was there subconsciously. Because I think for me, like, it would be great to, you know, gain a following, go viral for video content, but that's not the primary goal for me. You know, the primary was just to test to see, can I write something funny, can I edit it appropriately, and can I act in it, you know. And I think some videos execute that better than others, but you know, one thing I can say is I've put out a volume of content that I created myself from top to bottom. And you know, that's something that I'm proud of.
That's cool. So that, I find that very interesting. So you started basically acting in these videos because you couldn't find anyone else to do it, basically. Yeah. But did you come to start thinking, you know what, maybe I could actually do this acting thing as well?
Yeah, so I took acting classes earlier this year, for a couple weeks. And I actually enjoyed it a lot. The only thing was, I thought, you know, I tend to get into a lot of different things, as I imagine anyone that you interview on this podcast does.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I was like, well, maybe I should make sure I am the best writer I can be first, and then double down on the acting when I have more capacity to do that and potentially cast myself in something.
Okay, that's pretty So say you got a, I don't know, say somebody, you happen to meet somebody, a writer who was putting together a movie or some kind of screenplay, and they wanted you to act in it. Is that something you'd be open to?
Yeah, I'd be open to it. Yeah, yeah. Now, like, if you're talking about, am I going to be doing casting videos and, you know, calling up university students to get small parts? No. But if someone wanted me to do, you know, a part in something that they're producing themselves, yeah, I would go for it. Because I know I could do it. It's just a matter of what do I want to focus my energy on in pursuing at the moment.
Mm. Fair enough, fair enough. It's all about priorities, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So getting back to the writing, this is pretty interesting for me, because a lot of the things you do, I think there are things that I've at least thought about doing myself. Apart from the acting, I don't know. I am of the opinion that I was not born to act. I think that's, I don't think that's one of my many skills, but who knows? Maybe if I go to acting, take acting classes or something. I don't know. Because I remember when TikTok first came out, like when it was still very new, this was way before the pandemic. Back then, I used to follow Gary Vaynerchuk religiously, and he's been talking about TikTok since, like, I don't even know, 2017 or something like that. I can't remember the exact year. Don't quote me. But he's been talking about it for a while, and he was always talking about how TikTok was the future and how that kind of short form stuff is the way to go. And I, because of him, I downloaded TikTok on my phone. I was like, let me see what this thing is about. And I would watch the videos, and I'm like, man, I know Gary is saying this thing is the future, but these videos are ridiculous. I don't think I can do one of these videos.
Yeah.
And I think that's one problem I've always had, is like, I don't know, some people say I take myself too seriously. I think that contributed to that a little bit. But it's interesting. It was interesting for me to hear when you said, like, you didn't necessarily want to act in the videos, but out of necessity, you started acting in the videos just to act out the scripts that you wanted to write.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the past, I've also considered writing. Actually, when I was in boarding school, out of boredom, my two biggest hobbies were reading mostly fantasy books, actually. And I eventually decided to write one. I remember some of it, but you know, I was writing it on paper. This was boarding school in Nigeria, so we didn't have access to computers or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So we had a computer room, but it's not like we had access to it very often. So I was mostly writing it on paper and all that. And that was very interesting for me. But coming here for college, I kind of lost. Let me say I didn't have it was not a priority anymore. Let me put it that way. I won't say I didn't have the time, but it was not a priority anymore at the moment. But I've always thought I might go back and do something like that, but I'm not even sure where to begin, really. So if you had to give somebody a blueprint on how to become a writer, like how would you describe that?
I think probably one of the most important things you can do if you want to be, well, to write for television or film or even plays, but is to read a lot of scripts. Because, yeah, the way they write scripts is different than how you would write a book, obviously. So yeah, reading a lot of scripts, and then reading scripts of movies or television shows that you like while you're watching that movie or television show. So you can see how the words on the page translate to what happens on the screen. That is probably one of the most helpful things you can do just to understand the medium. And there are various books and online classes you can take to tell you how you should think about setting up a story and structuring it. I'd say it's a combination of both of those two things. As you start doing that, when you watch more television and movies, you'll notice the structure inherently, and you'll be able to call out why something is not working. Why does this movie not feel good to me? Why is this movie exciting to me? And that helps you in the way you write.
Hmm. Okay. That's very interesting. I'll have to give that a little bit of a try one day. I think some of what you're saying sounds a bit familiar. think probably the closest experience I've had to that was taking theater appreciation in college in my last semester because I didn't know what else to do at the time, basically. And I thought it was going to be stupid. I thought it was just a stupid class I have to take, whatever. But after that, I started liking plays. I developed an appreciation for plays. And in a way, they seemed more complete to me than movies, in a way, because it started to seem a lot more limiting to me how the movie forces you in the direction of what you're looking at. Whereas with the play, it's, I don't know how to describe it. It's like there, instead of, it felt almost like the TV is forcing you to look at one particular scene, whereas with the play, you have the entirety of the stage, basically. Of course, the stage is still showing you a particular scene, but it just felt more real somehow. But yeah, that's something, another hobby that died down at the end of the day there. But now that you kind of see behind the curtain a little bit, and you see all the tricks and whatever that's happening backstage, does that spoil it for you a little bit, or does that just open the door to more appreciation when you're watching a movie?
It can do both. Yeah. So on the spoiling side, yeah, like I'll watch certain things and I'm like, okay, this is the moment that there's a catalyst. I know the next couple of scenes are going to be the main character debating whether or not they should actually go on the adventure or not. And then after that, they go on the adventure. Like, I that's how I know it's going to happen. But then I appreciate when writers and directors take or demonstrate that differently than I expect. So I don't know if this is not directly related to the example I just gave, but if you ever seen the movie Inglourious Basterds,
Where they're hunting Nazis or something. I've seen it, but vague. I don't remember everything.
Yeah, so there's things in there that you probably appreciated, but then as a writer, you can appreciate more. So early in the movie, there's a scene where the Nazi leader, he comes to this house where there's Jewish people hiding under the floorboards, and the owner of the house starts smoking a pipe. And then you see the Nazi leader brings out a bigger pipe, right? And I think your immediate reaction is that, oh, that's a funny looking pipe. But really, what they were doing is showing you that the Nazi leader had the upper hand. So he has the bigger pipe. Yeah. And it's things like that you can do visually. Or you can write in the script so that it's portrayed visually that really show an attention to detail that separates certain writers from other writers, for sure.
That's interesting. So basically, there are certain things that make it an art form, and basically that demonstrate expression of that art form. Like, so the, for example, the bigger pipe in this scene here, why do you think that conveys that information so well? Is it a situation where It's just the way the art has developed, and now you being initiated in this stuff, you understand what they're doing when you see the bigger pipe? Or is it on some level human psychology where just seeing that he has a bigger pipe subconsciously conveys that he's in control of the situation there, or maybe a mix of both?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of both. Because I remember when I watched the movie in theaters, I wasn't thinking about that at all. I was just like, oh, that's just a big pipe. And it was like funny. I remember people laughed when they saw it. But if you combine that with what he's saying at the time, the entire conversation, he knows there are Jewish people underneath the house. But he's talking to the owner as if he doesn't know that. Mm-hmm. So when he brings it out, it's kind of like, aha, I have the upper hand on you. Like, and he obviously didn't know that this guy had a bigger pipe than him either. So it's things like that. And I can give probably a more recent example in the last Spider-Man movie, No Way Home. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where Peter Parker's in the condo, and all of a sudden his spider sense goes crazy. And then he walks around in a daze before he finally catches Green Goblin in the house, in the condo. Now, like, if you really think about that scene, compared to all the other movies he's been in, even when he was fighting Thanos and all them, his spider sense never went crazy like that. And that's kind of a cue you can take visually to the audience to show you that the enemy of Green Goblin that he was about to fight is his biggest threat. You know, is a threat that he's never come across before, and also tell you this is the big bad guy for Spider-Man, since this version of Peter Parker has yet to have met Green Goblin. So it's like, things like that you can do. It's like, I remember when I watched that in theaters, I was like, yes, that is A plus writing or direct cinematography right there, because it tells you a bunch of things without telling it to you verbally.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie, partly intentionally, but I think I can appreciate what you're saying there. I don't think I would necessarily say like he's not necessarily like his biggest adversary or the worst he has faced, but that's his Goblin to Spider-Man is like the Joker to Batman, kind of.
Yeah,
Lex Luthor to Superman. That's his guy, basically. That's what they're trying to signify there. That's pretty interesting. I'd love to delve more into the art form behind a lot of those things. So like earlier you mentioned earlier how there's some parts in the movie where you know, like, okay, that's when the guy is about to go on the adventure, and that kind of rang a bell. I think what you're referring to there is, I think they call it the hero's journey or something like that, the call to action in hero's journey.
Something
like, along those lines.
Yeah, you can call it the catalyst, the call to action. But yeah, usually there's the heroes presented with some either information or, you know, hey, you should or we should do this. And then somebody, whether it's the hero or someone else in the group, is like, no, I don't think so. Like, that's crazy. And then the very next scene, they're presented with some challenge that makes them think the crazy idea makes sense, you know. Or they're presented with some other information that, yeah, makes the crazy idea or the journey they're going to go on make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I remember when I first discovered the call to action thing and the hero's journey, it was one of those nights where it's like 1 a.m., I don't have anything better to do, and I'm on YouTube just falling down an endless rabbit hole on YouTube. And that was where I discovered it. And I remember my first reaction was that I didn't like it. It seemed a bit formulaic to me, that there was something about it I didn't like. But the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like it wasn't really about formulas or following a formula or just, I don't know, phoning stuff in. But it was just more so that there's just something about that kind of pattern that appeals to human senses. Like even as far back as if you think about very old African stories and I can't think of any Igbo stories at mind, but there's a Benin story about this guy. His name is Joromi. There's a song about it, actually. I'm not really Benin, but I'm a duo, but I've heard about this story. There's a song about it where he was a wrestler, if I remember correctly. He was a wrestler, and he basically was an undefeated wrestler, and he started challenging some spirits or something, and he went to the land of the dead or something like that, and he was challenging them to a fight, and his sister came as a fly to rescue him. It's basically the Edo version of Jack and the Beanstalk, kind of. That's okay. Basically what it is. Very strange story, but even old stories like that that we don't even, nobody really knows how old that story is, but if you really examine the story, even that follows the hero's journey and the call to action and all of that stuff. So it's really nice to see how it's almost like a universal truth, really. So following a formula or not, for some reason, those kind of stories just appeal to human senses.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because like if you look at like Things Fall Apart doesn't really follow that formula at all. Like a lot of the beginning of it is a bunch of like short stories that establish the culture of the people.
Yeah.
But it's not even really until, you know, Okonkwo gets run out of the village, which is kind of almost halfway through the book, if I remember right, that things really start to fall apart.
So I guess in every real art form, there's kind of like there's almost like there's a framework to work off of or to deviate from, and how you work off of it or how you deviate from it then becomes an expression of that art, really. Like a few episodes ago, I was doing an episode on this Afrobeats documentary, and somewhere in the documentary, they were talking about how a lot of Afrobeats is based on this, I think it was a 5-beat pattern they called it. It's like a boom, 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 like, no matter how the rhythm goes, a lot of it seems to be based on that 5-beat pattern that a lot of people mm-hmm. build off of. And even that too seems a bit formulaic, but for some reason it's prevalent all across the continent. A lot of that Fuji music or even some Amapiano music, if you really listen to it. And after I watched that, I started to really listen to it. And a lot of them really do follow that rhythm for some reason. And then the art, the mastery of the art form basically becomes how you can use that to in multiple layers to build something else, or how you can deviate from that in a clever way that people notice. So it's really interesting to look at that. But anyways, let's not get bogged down over there. Before we talk about your project, I was curious, because I am a big fantasy head myself. I love fantasy books, fantasy stories, fantasy movies. Like, ever since I was a kid, anything that has anything to do with mythology, I'm there. I'm picking it up. I'm reading it. I'm consuming all of it. So that when I saw your story, that caught my interest. But before we get into that, what is your favorite fantasy story or fantasy book, or anyone really, preferably a book?
That's a good question. Cause I mean, a lot of what I've read more recently is like Japanese manga, but I would definitely say, like, in school, like the Odyssey, like, yeah, that Greek, anything Greek mythology for sure was, you know, something I was interested in, even to the point where I took a Greek mythology class in college. But like the Odyssey is probably one of the deeper stories that, you know, I remember more broadly.
Yeah, that was, see, the similarities continue. It's funny you said that. I took a classics class in college because of that as well. The Odyssey, while not my favorite, that's one of the earliest ones I was exposed to. There was this movie about, I can't remember what the movie was called. Maybe it was called The Odyssey, but it was mostly about Odysseus and his journey back home after the, they didn't really show any of the Trojan War, which, now that I think about it, I guess that is The Odyssey, but I don't remember if that's what the movie was called. But that was one of my first exposures to Greek mythology. The Odysseus's journey, and then there was another one about Jason and the Argonauts, which was pretty interesting. So that was fun. The classics class, though, kind of exposed me to a little bit more. I think when I learned about Greek mythology before, it was a little bit romantic, and maybe the stories were kind of glossed over a little bit. Like a lot of the, watching a movie like Troy, for instance, like I saw Troy for the first time, I think I was 7 or something when I first saw Troy, and that captivated me too. But being in that class, I started to notice the differences between the Troy movie and the original story of what happened. What is that story called again? Is it
the Iliad?
Yeah, the Iliad. Yeah, I always get the Iliad and the Aeneid mixed up. Yeah, the Iliad. What actually happened there, and how they were actually fighting gods and all that. It was just pretty interesting. My personal favorite, though, is Lord of the Rings is my personal favorite. And the entire Lord of the Rings universe, really. Although recently I've discovered some grievances that I have with the story. I don't know if you can imagine what I mean by my grievances, but I think it's kind of like the bedrock for all of Western fantasy, basically. Everything seems to be loosely based on it in one way or the other. Have you ever read any of the Lord of the Rings books or anything in that universe?
I just watched the movies, and I feel like I've read some of the Hobbit stuff in school, but nothing where I could give you a, you know, expert conversation on details. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's fine. I wasn't expecting that. The movies, I don't know. Somehow I haven't read the books yet, which for me is odd. I mean, I have them in my audiobook library somewhere, but I haven't gotten around. I've seen the movies probably 100 times easily, but I need to read the books. What I was getting at is, if you like the movies, the Lord of the Rings movies, you should check out the Silmarillion, which is kind of like, essentially, it's a prequel for Lord of the Rings, basically. If I remember correctly, Tolkien wrote them backwards. I think he wrote Lord of the Rings. Actually, I think he wrote The Hobbit first. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, he wrote The Hobbit first, then he wrote Lord of the Rings. And then he went backwards and wrote the Silmarillion and all these other stories, basically building a mythology for what happened before, to explain a lot of things. And I find that part of the story even a lot more interesting than the Lord of the Rings itself. If you follow Rings of Power on Prime TV, the Amazon show they just made, it mentions some of that stuff, but they kind of gloss over it in the beginning.
Okay.
But that for me is very, very interesting. I think for me that's one of my biggest influences for fantasy stuff. So that's part of why I appreciate stories like your own very much. But let's dive into it now. I'll let you introduce it so you can set the pace for what you want to reveal and what you don't want to reveal, and we can dive into it some more from there.
Yeah. So I mentioned that I started off writing novels, and the first novel I wrote was called A Tale of Renown, which essentially is a reimagining of stories of the Greek Titans as if they lived during biblical times. More specifically, during the time on Earth before everything got flooded. Part of, you know, trying to get it published, I realized that a big key factor for it is the visualization, because it's like ancient times, there's angels involved, etc. So this past year I connected with an artist to adapt it into a graphic novel. So the goal now is that A Tale of Renown will be spaced out across a variety of volumes, so now you as the reader can visualize everything I'm trying to show you and tell you in this story. So there's giants, there's certain biblical characters that show up. I really did a deep dive on like some of the, I guess, Jewish mythology of the time. So diving some into the Book of Enoch.
I knew that stories. Was coming up.
Yeah. So diving into the Book of Enoch to try and make things add up so that you could potentially say, did this really happen? Maybe, if you believe in all that kind of stuff. I'm hoping that like people that love fantasy, as well as people that may not be so into fantasy, but, you know, love like Bible stories, etc., can really get into it and see what I'm trying to do. And hopefully it's not too predictable, but so far, so good.
Yeah, I don't think anything about this sounds predictable. I mean, when I from the link you sent me, I read about it a bit, and the first thing that jumped at me is this is like Bible story meets Greek mythology meets manga. Because looking at the cover, this looks like a manga story almost. Just looking at the cover. And just reading through the excerpts, it reminded me of several things. First of all, it reminded me of this movie, this Noah movie. And then that led me to thinking about the Book of Enoch. Have you seen the Noah movie that Russell Crowe was in? Yes. So I remember watching that movie and I loved it. It's one of my favorite movies. I bought the movie on Amazon. I loved it that much. Every now and then I go back and I watch it. But I remember that so many people I knew, they hated that movie because they were like, what is this? This isn't the Noah story I know. Where did they get this shit from? And I think it was because of that. I'd heard about it before, but I think it was because of that movie that I started getting more and more interested in the Book of Enoch and, you know, what do the actual Jewish books say and how are they a bit different from maybe the accounts that are in the Bible, and you start to see that there's some gaps a little bit. There's some stuff that you didn't read about in the Bible that's in the actual Jewish books, and even not just always reading from the books directly, but just reading about them, you start to read about stuff like Nephilim and, you know, all other giants and all this weird stuff that was going on. And I find that kind of stuff really interesting, but I realize some people just don't want to go down that road. So what led you into thinking, oh, you know what, let's explore that. Let's put some of that in here. And before that, have you seen the movie I was talking about? And what did you think of it?
I haven't seen it. I've seen clips, and then I've heard I've heard the criticisms. So I haven't seen it, to be honest. I probably have to check it out so I have a better opinion on how they did things versus how I'm doing things. But I guess to the point of, like, so actually this kind of goes back to your Lord of the Rings thing, because I remember I was watching Lord of the Rings, and like I think the very last movie, like that big final battle, and I was just like, wow, it'd be nice if there was one of these fights from the Bible shown at this scale. And then my mind immediately went to, well, the Bible talks about this war in heaven with angels. So what if that story was shown at this scale? And I had started to try and write a story about, like, you know, where like Lucifer is the main character or something like that, and his fall. But then I was like, I didn't know how to structure that in a way where you actually could believe Satan will win against God. So I was like, okay, well, what else could I write? And I was like, well, is there something with Cain and Abel? It's like, no, I don't think that has enough stakes. And I think somewhere I came across like the Nephilim stories, and that's when I was like, yes, this is, because like, I think if you look into the Book of Enoch, it's kind of like the flood happened because there were all these giants, and the world needed a big reset. So I was like, okay, that means that this peaceful earth got basically so terrible that God just wanted to do everything over. How can I tell that story? And that's where I was like, well, it'd be nice to kind of show that a bunch of different mythologies are all connected. And I thought the story of the Greek Titans was the easiest connection to make between the Nephilim and that.
I love how you tied all that together. There's a bunch of different stories that I find to be very, very interesting. The Noah movie, I'll defend that movie forever. I'll always defend that movie. I'll always defend them. I love the adaptation they made, because, I mean, especially if you're a Christian, right, or you go to church or you read your Bible, you've probably heard the Noah story like a billion times before.
Yeah.
So why do you want to see a movie that shows you the story exactly how you already know it's going to go every single time? You know, I mean, it follows the major things, right? God tells Noah to build an ark, builds an ark. There's a flood, family survives, you know, it follows the major things. But along the way, there's so much room, so much blank paper between all those facts that you know are supposed to happen in the story. And there's so much room for creativity in there. And that's what they did. They filled that space. And to their credit, they didn't just fill it with random stuff. Most of what they filled it in with, you can trace back to something that has something to do with Jewish books, or something that has some basis in, you know, some scripture, some kind of Jewish scripture. It's not like they're filling it up with random stuff like it's a Marvel movie or something. But it took a spin too. It took a little bit of what people consider to be a political spin, because something that somebody pointed out to me that I didn't notice before. I mean, I kind of picked up on it, like, oh, why are they always saying this? But I didn't notice how final, for lack of a better word, or the totality of it. Let me put it that way. So throughout the whole movie, and this is what the person pointed out to me, and I noticed they were using the word creator a lot. The creator did this, the creator did that, the creator did this. But I noticed throughout the whole movie, they didn't use the word God once.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not even once did they use the word God. They made a point of replacing the word in any situation or conversation where the word God could be used. They replaced it with the word creator. They would say, oh, the creator did this, the creator gave us this, the creator punished us. And a lot of people really took offense to that. A lot of people were really like, why did they go out of their way to replace the word God in it? And some people took it as a political statement of basically turning a biblical story into a science fiction. Basically, they felt like you turn a biblical story into a science fiction story, and that there was an element of maybe atheism in there, or I mean, at least agnosticism that people did not like. And it just kind of opened my eyes to how, even when you're telling a biblical story, a story that has to do with the Bible, the way you choose to express it can sometimes be you know, received in a different way. But do you kind of think about that kind of eventuality when you write your stories, or are you just more, is that something you take into account, or do you think the story you're trying to tell is should be the main focus, and it doesn't really, maybe some people are always going to receive it the way they'll receive it?
No, yeah. I think it definitely matters. I think in that case, right, because Noah is definitely a patriarch of Abrahamic faiths. So to not have him reference, you know, God or even Allah, if you wanted to go the Muslim route, I see people's annoyance with that. You know, that would be like you're watching Moses and Moses is saying the creator gave me this rod instead of, you know, God. So I get that. But even in my story, I don't say God. I have another name that I use. It's not creator. It's something else. But
yeah.
But at the same time, my story does not focus on Noah. Noah is a side character. And that's probably going to be a big difference. And I hope that doesn't, you know, leave me in the same doghouse with people that felt that. But
yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Moses, because right after they did Noah, I think like a year or 2 years after that, they made Exodus, which was based on Moses. And that one was even more controversial, I think. Even I have a few qualms with that one. I like to think I'm somewhat open-minded, but I had a few bones to pick with that one too. And I think I've only seen it twice versus Noah that I've probably seen like 50 times. So that in of itself says something.
Yeah, I imagine probably the biggest controversies I'll get are the skin tones I used in my book. Because, you know, as you can see from the cover, this is not a Caucasian version of history.
Yes. Yeah, that's part of what I meant when I said I have some grievances with the Lord of the Rings universe. I mean, I don't want to point any fingers. There are two reasons why I don't really like to get into that much. Because one, I'm not entirely convinced that it was intentional. And two, Tolkien claimed that his motivation for creating the Lord of the Rings stories was to create in his own words, a legendarium for Britain. So he wanted to basically, according to him, Britain didn't really have a story, and he wanted to create a story that was them. I'm not really sure why he said that. I think King Arthur is that story, but I don't know why he said that, but I think he references that somewhere. But basically one day I'm watching Lord of the Rings, and for like, I don't know, the 70th time, and for some reason this time it hit me. Why are there first of all, I always knew that there were no black characters in Lord of the Ring. Mm-hmm. But then I noticed that, you know, some of the bad guys, the Easterlings and those guys who serve Sauron, they're kind of brown skin. Like they're like,
yeah,
maybe not black, but they're like, maybe you could say like they're maybe Arab or that kind of skin tone, like that olive skin tone. They're brown skinned a little bit. And then it occurs to me that the closest thing to black people in this movie are the orcs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're the evil bad guys who were created by, you know, torturing and twisting the elves who are, you know, fair and blonde haired and all that. And something about that just rubbed me the very, very wrong way. And eventually I found some video on YouTube that was talking about that too. So apparently I'm not the only person that picked up on this. But I don't really like to, I don't know, I don't want to point fingers, because even though, I mean, Tolkien did live in the early 1900s and a lot of people were racist during that time, I cannot definitively say that he did it on purpose. So I just kind of leave that aside sometimes. Although I side-eye Lord of the Rings now because of that. But anyways, out of curiosity, I was wondering if there was another, and you tell me if you don't want to give away something here. There's another, let me say, branch of stories that I stumbled upon at some point. So I didn't really grow up Muslim for most of my life, but my dad is Muslim. So at some mm-hmm. point I practiced Islam at some point, and I got it. It was like, even though my dad was Muslim, I didn't really know much about Islam before I went to boarding school and I delved into it a little bit. So I got exposed to like a whole other line of stories that I didn't know existed before. So, you know, growing up reading the Bible and, you know, going to church or whatever, you know the normal stories, the Noah, the Moses, Joseph, Jacob, all the usual characters. And in Islam, all of those characters exist too. Pretty much everybody in the Old Testament exists in Islam. But the stories are a bit different. Like, for example, in the beginning, in the Bible, in the beginning, God creates Adam and Eve, or God creates Adam. He's in the garden. Starting at the actual beginning, God creates the earth, it's void. He creates the sea, all that, day, night. Then he creates the animals and he creates Adam to watch over them. Adam is lonely, creates Eve from the rib, right? In the Islamic version of the story, God, before God created humans, so he created angels. He creates mm-hmm. the angels from light, the story goes, and
jinn from fire, right?
Exactly. So he creates the jinn from fire, and after that, when the jinn are basically disobedient or they're not good stewards of the earth, then he decides to create humans from clay. He creates Adam from clay or dust or whichever one you want to call it. So as soon as I learned about that, it was like, oh, wow. It was like my brain just exploded. I just learned about all these creatures I never knew existed before. And I was just consumed with learning everything that I could about them. And I discovered this book too. In boarding school, books were like, they were like currency, damn near currency, basically. There was this trilogy, the Bartimaeus trilogy. It was about these race of magicians that controlled jinn, and they drew their power from jinn and used them to perform their magic and everything. I kind of delved into it a little bit. So when I was saying I wrote that book in boarding school, it was heavily influenced by a lot of that. So I was writing about a story about jinn as well. So when you mentioned earlier that when you considered writing your story, you wanted to write something about the war in heaven and Lucifer, but didn't really know how to put it in a way where, you know, there are actual stakes and Lucifer could actually win. It kind of reminded me of the difference in stories on both sides. So in the Christian version of the story, at least the common Christian version of the story, let me say, Lucifer is God's most favorite angel and the most beautiful head of the choir or whatever. I mean, sometimes you hear these stories and I don't even know where people got it from. Like, people say that he led the choir in heaven. I don't know where that is in the Bible. I don't even know if that's in the Bible, but so the story goes. Due to his pride, he's cast out of heaven and some other angels come to earth, have sex with human women and all of that stuff, all of that jazz. So in the Christian version, Lucifer is, you get the impression that Lucifer is like I don't think you ever get you don't really get the impression that he's as powerful as God, but you get the impression that he's like, you know, after God is him. He's like, he's number two.
Yeah.
Almost. Whereas in the Muslim version, the Islamic version, Lucifer or Iblis is not even, he's not even an angel. He's a jinn. He's a really, really powerful jinn. Probably as powerful as some angels, the way the story goes, but he's not like that number two guy, probably not even the number three guy, but you get the impression that he's powerful. So in the Islamic version, it's never, you get the impression, and maybe I'm wrong here, I don't know the Islamic stories as well as some people do, but you get the impression that there is never any risk that, you know, Lucifer is that dangerous to the angels per se. It's just, the closest thing to the Islamic version in the Bible is the story of Job, where Satan is basically saying to God, oh, this guy, he's only serving you because you gave him all this nice stuff and you blessed him with all these wives and these wonderful children and these riches. If I take all of them away, he will curse your name, basically. So Satan is not even pretending like he can win. It's almost like, you know what? I'm going to show you that these humans are not, they're not worth your time. They're not worth your love.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. That's kind of how the Islamic version goes, where Lucifer's whole, he's not even really necessarily planning to win. It's just some huge temper tantrum where he's trying to show God that humans ain't shit, basically. So that's like the grandest story of all. And it's interesting to see how on two different sides, the story is different. And you wonder where those differences come from. But hopefully that's the kind of thing you can kind of explore in your story, not necessarily with Lucifer, but with how you merge different mythologies with biblical stories, maybe.
No, yeah, I think to that point, because, as Christians, you are really just taught Lucifer is the, Satan is the adversary, and there's no names for anyone else that's a problem. But like, as I was researching for this story, the more I read about these angels that, you know, slept with these humans, the more I learned that their punishment is even almost worse than Satan's. In the Bible, you know? So, like, later in the story, you see Satan interact with these angels and taunt them that, you know, that they've messed up more than he has. And I think it's an interesting, you know, way to frame it that, like, you know, yeah, there's more than one group of angels that messed up, you know? But, you know, it's not something that we think about. In church conversations.
Yeah. I definitely love when stories like these are explored. Again, shout out to Noah. You know, hopefully they put me as an extra on this Noah 2 if they ever make another one. But I definitely love stories like that. That's why this jumped out at me so much as something I definitely would want to read. This is right up my alley, basically. Have you seen the show Supernatural?
I've seen some episodes, but I haven't like watched it top to bottom.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they delve into this kind of stuff too. And you know, that's another thing that I've binged multiple times, so you can tell this is my wheelhouse pretty much. But yeah, great stuff. I can't wait to read it. When is it supposed to be out again? I think it's saying February on here.
Yeah, the right now, if people subscribe to the mailing list, they can get the first chapter for free as a sample. But the book will launch February 7th. I'm still doing some things behind the scenes to get the pre-order link live, but it will be on ebook and on paperback.
Okay. So this will kind of read. A bit like, I know you said it's a graphic novel. This kind of read like a manga, or what should we expect on that front?
Yeah, so the entire story is full color. There's 86 pages in it, 90 if you include the front and back. So it's multiple chapters, comic book style. With full color, all that. but it doesn't read right to left like a manga.
Yeah. I figured.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think like if you're a comic fan, then it should be right up your alley. And I think it is something different where, like, technically this is like black fantasy, even though for these characters, like being black isn't a distinction, you know, but you know, I wanted to create characters and I had to make sure I guided the artist well, like, hey, like this guy's lips are not big enough. Like, they need to look black. Like, or like, in earlier versions, I was like, no, make his hair curly. Like, don't be giving him that straight hair. I need people that look like me to see themselves in the characters.
Yeah, I could definitely see the kink in that hair there. So just for the guys listening at home, this is not a kid's novel. Just throwing it out. I think recommended age 15 plus. One thing that made me chuckle though is when it was like warnings, violence, brief sexual activity. I was like, what? What is brief?
There's one page where, you know, things are suggested, you know. So it's not as graphic as Game of Thrones as far as the sexual piece.
Yeah.
But I will say in that Game of Thrones realm, expect that people you think are main characters may not last long, you know, and all that kind of thing. Okay.
I'm looking forward to it. So guys, again, the name is A Tale of Renown. I'll have the link in the show notes. I'll also have your IG handle in the show notes if you want to put it in there. Sure. We're actually over an hour already, then time flies. But before we close out, have you heard of Black Sands Entertainment?
I have, yes.
Yeah, when you were talking about black comics, that just rang a bell in my head. There's I've been following their stuff for a while too. I'm kind of lazy, so I haven't really read the ebooks, but whenever I find short form videos about it on YouTube, I always watch those. So I like what they're doing as well. They're basically doing what you're doing, but based on ancient Egypt, essentially, which I like, but I feel like it might be getting tired a little bit. You know, it can't be Egypt all the time, but I get why he's doing what he was doing. I have no fault with it at all, but I like to see stories from other places like, I don't know, maybe an Igbo mythology story or something like that. This book I read a while ago kind of felt like that. Children of Blood and Bone. You could tell it was loosely based on like Nigerian culture, like the names they were using and the practices.
But yeah.
It was supposed to be some fantasy, some made up place, but it was very well based on Nigerian culture. So kind of stuff like that. It doesn't have to be Nigerian, you know, like Kenyan or whatever.
Yeah.
From Congolese, whatever. But I just think we should explore a little bit of some more of those African stories in addition to Egypt, which I mean, I'm a big fan of Egyptian mythology as well, but I feel like that stuff is getting a bit played out now.
Yeah, I would definitely say as I start wrapping up with Tale of Renown, because right, this is only volume one of what could be maybe 9 volumes, depending on how I pace it. But yeah, I do have plans to tell other stories that kind of touch exactly what you're doing without me saying too much. But you know, if one day you just see the advertisement, then you know what's coming. But yeah, to that point, it's like, yeah, there's so much mythology out there besides Norse, Greek, and Egyptian, you know? But somehow that's what gets highlighted. But even like in the Japanese manga, they do incorporate some of their stuff into some of the names. Like a lot of the names and stories like Naruto are from Japanese gods.
Yeah.
And then even now on Hulu, there's some Bollywood movies about some Indian gods and stuff like that. So
Yeah, I know a lot of stories do take in stuff like that. Even Naruto, like you were saying, apart from the Japanese gods, I think there's a lot of influence from Buddhism, and I think maybe even a little bit of Hinduism too. Like they talk about how, for example, the paths of pain in Naruto are all from samsara.
Yeah.
I think it's a Buddhist concept, or could be Hindu, you know, from Hinduism as well. I know they're somehow related. So they do delve into that, which is nice. I like to see the complexity, the fact just seeing that stuff was actually thought out to that degree. I definitely have a lot of appreciation for that. And there's some that's way out there, like there's this anime, I think it's on Netflix. I forgot what the full name is. Something Ragnarok, Contest of Ragnarok.
Oh,
something.
Yeah. I don't know.
Which is very, it's just funny the way they did it. But like you said, it's like everything, a lot of things seem to be either Greek, Norse, or Egyptian mythology, or some weird combination of all of them. So it's nice to delve out of that sometimes.
Yeah, and to that point, even when they combine all of them in the same story, Zeus is always the king of everything, you know?
Exactly.
I don't like that messaging at all.
Exactly. It is very weird because it doesn't make any sense, because like in Contest of Ragnarok, for example, they have all these gods, some of them really, really old gods from the oldest civilizations ever, yet somehow Zeus is still the guy in charge somehow, which, you know, I mean, we know why that is, but it doesn't make any sense. If you, no matter how you flip it, it doesn't really make any sense. But so it is. That's why we have to make more stories like that. That's why I love what guys like yourself and Black Sands Comics are doing, because we need more stories like that. It just has to happen. Have you seen another example of that is Neil Gaiman's story? I haven't actually read the book, but the show is on. Is it Stars? I think it's Stars.
Is it Sandman?
No. I've seen Sandman. That I like. I like this one too. But what's it called again? American Gods.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that too. There are a lot of old gods, like Hindu gods, African gods, and all that. Yet somehow on both sides, the guys that are, you know, leading the war on both sides are old white guys. You know, but that's what happens when you don't write your own story, basically.
Exactly.
So that's why I like these kinds of initiatives. But anyways, not to make this too long, do you want to say anything to the listeners before we close out? Any plugs you want to put in, anything like that? Now's the time.
Yeah, as mentioned, A Tale of Renown is launching February 7th, 2023, or Volume 1 at least. So definitely feel free to follow myself at Uzal the Creator, or my publishing / creative imprint at Smash Studios on social media, if you want to stay tuned for more updates. And yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Sounds good, man. Thanks for coming on. This has been a very interesting conversation for sure. I can't wait to read A Tale of Renown. For anyone that wants access to that stuff, I will be putting that information in the show notes. So just look for it there. I'll also tag them on Instagram when I get around to putting out a reel or something like that about this episode. Thanks for tuning in and listening. If you enjoyed it, please rate the show, share. I had to switch hosting sites recently, and it was not as smooth as it should have been. So it kind of lost the ratings that we had before. So if you like the show, please rate, please share, like on Instagram, follow, all that good stuff. And we'll see you guys next time, or listen to you guys. I don't know, whatever. You know what I mean. See you guys next time.